Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is making her maiden voyage, Jeannie Ives, former state rep from Wheaton, Republican gubernatorial and congressional candidate, now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas. Jeannie, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it's great.
Gonna be fun. So, because of Breakthrough Ideas, you're still fully engaged in everything that's happening on the ground in Illinois and the Chicagoland area. That certainly would include all things COVID-related. We haven't heard much from the General Assembly. It still is a functioning body, or at least it's still a body.
Yeah.
So this story out of Center Square is where I saw it, actually, Greg Bishop. State puts school on probation for relaxing mask mandate. Southeastern Illinois School District has been put on probation for relaxing its mask guidance. If it doesn't change, it could lead to the closure of the school. Red Hill School District and Representative Adam Nieberg's district down there in southeastern Illinois. So wait a second. I thought that we were going in the direction of opening and we were preparing for a different kind of school year come the fall. And now we see Jelly Belly wearing a mask this week, and we see the Illinois State Board of Education threatening a school down south.
Well, on top of it, he expanded his he extended his 30-day disaster declaration, or COVID provision, saying that hey, if you're still going to school, summer school, then you have to wear a mask. I mean, I literally live next door to the elementary school where kids are getting dropped off daily for summer school, and they get out of their car, they put their mask on. They're greeted by the administrator who walks them into the school, and she's got a mask on. And what do we know? Fauci lied. I mean, masks don't work. We already know that. We said it in the email, but then he lied to the public. And these school districts have, I'm telling you right now, superintendents are the most cowardly people of all bureaucrats in the entire state of Illinois. They won't stand up for their people. They won't stand up for their kids.
So we see these sort of double challenges going on simultaneously, these two challenges going on simultaneously. One is the curriculum when the schools do reopen or restart, even if they're sort of open, sort of not open. And then we see the lingering COVID restrictions, even against the backdrop of the CDC reiterating again that vaccinated people don't need to wear masks, even amid all the hysteria they're helping to generate regarding the Delta variant. But they don't need to wear masks, and kids should be back in school. This is something even the CDC, even the Faucis of the world have been saying since last fall, since late 2020. Mm-hmm. And still we're in this place in Illinois. There was litigation against the emergency orders in perpetuity that Pritzker has affected. That went nowhere. The General Assembly has been nowhere. You have some school districts, some parents and even students in some school districts challenging their school boards. But it seems like you're going to have local officials in concert with the state officials, starting with the governor, perpetuate this as long as they humanly can.
He's absolutely signaling with this 30-day expansion of his executive order that he intends to take this as far as he can. And now, finally, you're seeing a little bit of questioning by the superintendents. The Large Unit District Association, it's a consortium of unit districts around the state. They sent a a letter to the ISBE, the Illinois State Board of Education. They said, look, we need to know your guidance up front. We need to know it ahead of time. There, if you're still going to allow forces to social distance even at 3 feet, yet you're demanding that 100% of the student population comes back in the fall for in-person learning, we can't make that work. It's physically impossible to put the two together. So where's the guidance? What are you going to do? So you'd see a little bit of pushback from these superintendents, but not enough. They should just 100% take back control over their school districts, and they're not doing it. They're super weak.
And this is despite the fact that even in a General Assembly controlled by a supermajority of Marxists, they were unable to move the legislation that would have given Illinois Department of Public Health dominion over all the schools to decide when you're allowed to open, when you're not. That didn't go anywhere.
That's right. No, it didn't go anywhere. But the other thing about this, in the rhetoric behind his extension for 30 days, Pritzker basically was saying that he may make an executive order on both public and private schools on how they have to operate in the fall. So what he couldn't get passed in legislation that his crony Illinois Education Association wanted in that bill, HB 2789, it appears that he may be putting it in place in an executive order come fall.
Well, so if you can't get through the general, you can't get something through the General Assembly, you do it by fiat. But the problem,
well, it's just like Biden, right?
Yeah, and what's his? It would say, well, he can't do that because that's the General Assembly's purview, and his response will be, take me to court.
That's right.
Go ahead, we'll litigate it.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, my executive order will be enforced. And let's see. It's almost like a trial balloon. Let's just do this by executive order, and let's see if people even care. Let's see if people even move to enjoin the effect of the executive order word I issue. And let's see where the pockets of resistance are or where they aren't. Why not use executive orders to do a little bit of polling, if you will? And it's amazing to me now, too. I mean, it's not amazing.
Well, probably because he's back up to, 57% approval rate? He probably,
sure.
I mean, you know.
Sure. This is going very well. This is going great. He's doing a great job.
People are buying into this. I was driving down through Wheaton, and sure enough, there's a guy in the middle of a rainstorm waiting to cross the street wearing a mask.
Yeah.
I'm like, are you crazy?
Yeah. I almost ran a guy in a Corolla wearing a mask off the road because he was doing 45 in the left lane this morning.
So this tells me, is this Illinois? Is this what people think? And now there has been pushback at school boards. And in fact, I went to my own school board in June. That was kind of fun because, you know, they know who I am.
Sure.
I hate to use that, but they do know who I am.
I'm sure they do.
And so I went up there to talk about, it was a little bit of a divide and conquer with my friend Kathleen. She talked to them about critical race theory, which is infused in the Wheaton School District. Let me know. But I talked to them about masks. I talked to them specifically about their vaccination policy in the fall. And I said, look, you need to tell people up front what you're going to do. And then all of a sudden this executive order comes out and it looks like they want a mask again. I am so opposed to this. I mean, my daughter dancing in show choir with a mask on, it's ridiculous because she's going right out the school, ripping the mask off and talking one-on-one with her friends.
You have these Marxist governors and state legislatures taking more strident positions than the CDC. So, for example, L.A. County, you heard, again, Dr. Rochelle Walensky saying vaccinated people don't have to wear masks despite the Delta variant. L.A. County is urging vaccinated people to wear masks again. You know, when a guidance becomes an urge, becomes a mandate. L.A. County, vaccinated people wear masks. And so, again, if it's happening in L.A. or New York, you can be sure if it's not already happening in Chicago, it will be. Brian in Oak Forest.
Hey, good morning, guys. So they have those signs popping around the front yard, the pink ones that say unmask the kids. And I sent an email, a picture of that to all the local school boards in my area, the local village officials, Oak Forest, Tinley, and Orland. I think I may have attached you to it, Dan, not sure, but I got a really cool response from, and I sent it yesterday morning or late Tuesday night, and I got a really cool response from the Village of Orland Park mayor, and he appears to have a really aggressive stance against these masks and vaccines and whatnot. So if I was you, I would I suggest you find that and play some clips because it was really impressive. And I kind of feel like you made it because of my email. So
thanks for the call, Brian. Appreciate it. Well, Keith Peacow, the mayor of Orland Park, is like the best public official in the state. It was funny. I was having this conversation with a friend yesterday. Name officials that you think are doing a good job or have like you have respect for. And it was like, Keith Peacow, Darren Bailey. Okay, that's my list. In the state of Illinois.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former state representative and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives, now the principal of Breakthrough Ideas. Jeannie, great to have you here. I don't know if you joined in the feting of the Chinese Communist Party that CNN ushered in yesterday. Chinese Communist Party is about to turn 100, but Xi will be the real star, or as some wag put it, CNN is that network now. I mean, it's sort of remarkable. The Chinese Communist Party. So let's think about all of the hits, maybe going in reverse from present day to at least the Glorious Revolution. The concentration camps. Is that what we're celebrating? The handling of the COVID outbreak. Is that what we're celebrating? The intellectual piracy. There's so much to celebrate. She has been a real star, according to CNN. And, you know, this persists in the conversation about origins here. James Freeman, writing in the Journal, a former Chinese communist academic, now a critic of the regime, urging the U.S. to abandon naive hopes to engage with Beijing, while warning that the country's leadership is more fragile than it appears. You know, this is a point that Gordon Chang has made, too. Mm-hmm. The left always assumes that America is going to lose to its totalitarian adversaries. These are the same people who thought that we would be relegated to the ash heap of history, not the Soviet Union. And Gordon Chang's book, The Coming Collapse of China, or The Coming China Collapse, makes this very point that this former Chinese Communist Party shill in the academy there is making. Wishful thinking about engagement must be replaced by hard-headed defensive measures to protect the United States from the CCP's aggression while bringing offensive pressures to bear on it, as the Chinese Communist Party is much more fragile than Americans assume, Ms. Kai wrote in a 28-page paper that's slated for publication this week by the Hoover Institution over at Stanford. Kai Xia, if I'm pronouncing that right, is a former professor at Beijing's Central Party School. I think scholarships are still available from the government school systems here to that Beijing Central Party School. But this deference to fascination with China and a lot less enthusiasm for America from this camp.
Well, you know, that's the Democrat Party. I mean, they absolutely don't want to take this on. I still find it a problem for China that I think they've overextended themselves to some degree. They've invested in all sorts of other exploits outside of their own country. And I think at some point that they can't sustain any of that, from their adventures into Africa with their Belt and Road initiatives. I think some of this problem, they're seeing a problem in universities where they've paid off professors here in the United States. And I don't think Americans are going to put up with that long. And by the way, I mean, they can invest all they want in the West. They can buy up a lot of our debt. But at the end, unless you take and hold ground, you can't really control that country. And I think that they're going to find that they are running out of resources, that they've got a brewing sort of distrust of the country. And I think that there's a lot of people here that I talk to that are Chinese that came from China and came to America for freedom. I think they're going to help stoke the revolt with their for their friends back in China.
We heard from one Chinese immigrant in the Loudoun County School District in Virginia who gave them chapter and verse, which was fantastic. We've heard from another one up here in New Trier on that two boys kissing issue, which is great, too. I mean, they know what it's like to live under censorious authoritarians. But it's just fascinating to me. We're at a place now where the Democrat Socialist Party does not want to observe Independence Day here, but does want to observe the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, the great leap forward that led to famine, the Cultural Revolution that disappeared 5 to 40 million people, to current day where you have 95 million CCP apparatchiks ruling 1.4 billion people by threat of arrest and dissent. You had Apple Daily just shut down Jimmy Lai's paper in Hong Kong. The word Tiananmen is still verboten in China. And yet you have leading lights of the intellectual left like Ezra Klein saying, you know, it's not so bad if TikTok wants to propagandize on behalf of the Chinese communists to make us like China a little bit more. You have others on the left suggesting that China is more of the model than the United States for how to organize a free society or a civil society. Clearly not a free society. It's just remarkable. And that this also speaks to our COVID response, which now we have to go back and look at the relationship to the WHO, which is Chinese controlled by that Chinese stooge that's in there, Tedros from Ethiopia. We have to look at the interaction between all of these NIH-funded politico scientists, including at the behest of Tony Fauci, as well as Francis Collins and previous directors, and just what exactly that relationship is, what exactly we're underwriting as we do so much underwriting of our enemies.
Well,
it's
we
just
are.
Remarkable.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's obviously the U.S. government's not in there underwriting it, but the American corporations are there underwriting the entire Communist Chinese Party. And I mean, you kind of want to compare it to the Soviet Union, where they were the big monster, they were all powerful, that there was, you know, an outbreak of war is quite possible. These people have a lot of strength. And then what you find out underneath it is they had a crumbling economy. There was political unrest brewing. They had a problem on their Western front with the Eastern countries like Poland. And they weren't as strong as they looked. And I'm hoping that that's the case with China, that they really do. Their strength is not there. But the difference here is that you have U.S. companies investing in China, still continuing to invest in China and fueling all of their economic activity. And it just creating this. We didn't have that. We didn't have U.S. companies investing heavily in the Soviet Union, our enemy.
Yeah.
And if you don't think that China's our enemy, I just don't know what you're thinking.
Well, it's interesting because one, they have this demographic problem. We do, too. But they really have a demographic problem, which is why they've moved from their disastrous and grotesque one child policy to two child policy to now three child policy. So they got a people problem there. Bill McGurn,
they probably still need some North Korean wives, though, for a lot of those men.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's what they do.
Bill McGurn had a good piece in the Journal this week, too. Sort of, was Milton Friedman wrong? Recounting what Milton Friedman said at the turn of the century, that as China offered more economic freedom, it would gain more political freedom. And that hasn't happened.
Mm-mm.
And its size, 1.4 billion people, is in part what allows China to get away with their inhumanity, because it's such a huge economic market. You've got 1.4 billion people as potential customers. So it's a huge economic market for corporate America, including entertainment America, Disney and the NBA.
That's
for
right.
Examples.
Yeah. But underlying all this, there was a pretty good book that I read. It was actually written by a University of Illinois professor called The Travels of a T-Shirt in a Global Economy. And it talked about everything that built your $10 T-shirt in Florida. It was kind of fascinating. Went through, you know, the cotton industry that we subsidize and support and protect here in the U.S. and that cotton going over to China and getting produced into a T-shirt. And a lot of that sort of niche marketing in particular industries have moved out of China as people found more productive means into the higher tech fields for them and has moved into Southeast Asia. So then you had growing economies there.
Pushed in part by Trump policies.
Well, yeah, this has been happening, though, for, you know, 20 years now.
Right.
That you've had this movement out of China into the Southeast Asian countries for better economic terms for them. And as China's economy did grow and people did gain some income growth themselves personally, you saw them moving into different jobs and off the farms and into other manufacturing, which is great. But, I mean, this is actually what needs to happen with our American companies. They need to start moving out of China into friendlier environs and protecting our national interests in this way. And
Vietnam, South Korea.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I when I find a shirt and it was made in Vietnam, I'm a lot happier, quite frankly.
And you mentioned as well the – and by the way, it's sort of like a modern iteration of iPencil, that T-shirt that's
yes.
around the world. Yeah, that's good. You mentioned the academy, academics, and this the China influence, the Confucius Institutes, and the influence of Chi Coms in our higher education institutions. Also this, again, getting back to COVID, story out from the National Pulse, which has been doing good work on this. The Galveston National Laboratory in Texas, a project of Tony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, has engaged in long-term personnel exchanges and training programs with the Wuhan Institute of Virology's Biosafety Level 4 facility. They did, we had our researchers training Wuhan researchers, Wuhan Virology Lab researchers, how to work with the world's most dangerous pathogens, according to this look-see. You know, maybe that, again, this is sort of like the idea exchange among scientists. Maybe that makes sense, but the way that this has been addressed by the Francis Collinses and the Tony Faucis of the world leaves me a little unsatisfied, because they are either really Pollyannish or
yes.
they're disingenuous, one of the two. The idea that that China has good scientists, I don't dispute that.
No.
But the issue is, who do they answer to, and what exactly is their mandated objective, you know, at the point of a gun? And Fauci and Collins and that crew seem to say, we know them, we talk to them, we like them, they're good scientists, that's all that matters. It's not all that matters.
No, but bottom line here is, in many of these institutions, especially public universities, they are looking for the cash that comes with those Chinese students that come over. I mean, nobody probably remembers this except for me,
right.
But it's remarkable that the University of Illinois actually took out an insurance policy for 3 years at the cost of $1.2 million in the event that their Chinese student population declined. They took out an insurance policy, $1.2 million to protect it.
Because it's a cash cow for
well,
U of I.
Your alma mater, Northwestern, actually looked at that same deal, and they declined to do it, saying that the cost for the insurance was too high. But, of course, when you're using taxpayer money, you'll pay anything to just protect that stream of revenue that you have. And so they're so dependent on these Chinese students. You know, Eastern Illinois has a huge Chinese student program and exchange program as well.
And the thing about that, I mean, it's a twofold problem. One is, you know, what exactly is the purpose here? And should if we're, you know, educating senior level CCP members, should we really be in the business of doing that, even if they're going to pay full freight? So that's a legitimate area of inquiry. But in addition to that, and you've talked about this, too, the idea of foreign nationals, not just from China, foreign nationals displacing in-state residents for a land-grant state university
mm-hmm.
because they pay full freight, not based on the academics, but because they pay full freight, that's a violation of the terms of the land-grant university. Right?
Yeah, but it still occurs to this day.
Oh, I have no doubt. But I mean, it's just
it is funny. So my son graduated from U of I in electrical engineering. And of course, when we go to the graduation ceremony, it's segregated by school. So it's just the folks in the electrical engineering.
Now it's segregated by race, by
yeah,
gender identity, by everything else.
Oh, gosh. But I mean, literally, his was the one name that the announcer did not have to have phonetically spelled on the back of the card. Right. I mean, they were far outnumbered by foreign nationals that were getting those degrees.
You know why that is, of course.
Why?
Structural racism.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yes.
This was a topic, too, Heather McDonald took up in the journal. The NIH we were talking about, Francis Collins org there. That's where they're focused. They're obsessed with diversity like NASA and everything else. You wonder why.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I read this article.
The new requirement for research applications from NIH, grant applications, is to show how they will enhance diverse perspectives through their research. Part of what Collins calls his continuing effort to atone for biomedical science's stain of structural racism. And the NIH already supports more than 60 diversity and inclusion initiatives, but as Heather McDonald Riley says, apparently those have failed to eradicate the systemic and structural racism at NIH. Collins, and here it is, it's outcome-based, right?
Right.
So Collins says, what's evidence of our structural racism? Black population, 13.4%. In 2020, black scientists made up 2.3% of funding applications and received less than 2% of NIH grants. So if they're 13% of the population and they received only 2% of the grants, obviously that must be the stain of structural racism. Well, maybe it's not so obvious. I know this is uncomfortable, but research by Brookings Institute scholars, Brookings Institute left. Michael Hansen, Diana Quintero. Black high school students spend a little more than a quarter of the time on homework that Asian students do and half the time of white students. The average black math score on the SAT in 2020 was 454 out of 800, 547 for whites, 632 for Asians. I know the SAT is racist, so we just eliminate that.
Those high schools didn't have enough critical race theory, though, to close that achievement gap, because you see, if you infuse the oppressor in the oppressed class, then you're going to close that achievement gap, and this is no longer a problem. And that is actually what they are arguing about in our local public schools right now, in the suburbs, everywhere.
Of course. Okay, so eliminate the SAT. What about actual degrees?
Oh, yeah.
What about earning degrees in particular disciplines? Does that matter? Educational attainment in STEM fields. In 2019, 20 blacks nationwide received a doctorate in a neuroscience field. 20, not 20%, 20.
20 total. Yeah.
1.9% of all such degrees awarded the neurosciences. There were 3 newly minted black PhDs in biophysics, 1.7% of the total. 21 in biochemistry, 2.6%. Genetics and genomics, 2.3% of the total. Molecular biology, 2.5%. Nanotechnology, electrical engineering, a feeder into nanotechnology, 1% of the total. So you're telling me then these institutions of higher education dominated by the left for at least a half a century, and certainly now, and obsessed with race and identitarianism, generally speaking. Structural racism explains this?
No. How did we produce Ben Carson, Dr. Ben Carson?
Well, I mean,
he produced himself.
Well, but also all these black students who did achieve PhDs,
yes,
in these fields. It's just not, I agree, it's too few.
Absolutely.
I want everybody who has the ability and the work ethic to achieve whatever they want to achieve. I don't care. It's great. But the idea that you're going to focus here when it's a fraud. It's just a fraud, and it papers over the underlying reasons why there are so few NIH grantees that are black and PhDs in these STEM fields that are black. It papers over them because it's not about helping other people. It's about aggrandizing yourself at our expense, both financially and in terms of America's future.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former state representative and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives. And Jeannie, has the Me Too movement been dealt a blow by the announcement yesterday that by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that it was vacating the sexual assault conviction of one Bill Cosby, setting him free after he served about 3 years in prison.
Well,
or is the Me Too movement even still a thing?
You know, you haven't heard about it, have you, since Biden got into office? It's not a thing anymore, even though he's had his own allegations of sexual assault.
Tara Reid, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, here's the deal, though. How does this prosecutor get away with charging him again, probably knowing what the outcome might be?
Well, I don't think he can be charged again because it seems to me that...
Well, they basically dropped the criminal case, right? That's my understanding. And then he was, then they put together a civil case, which he thought he then incriminated himself in that civil case. And then they came back,
right,
and tried him.
Yes, but here's the problem: is it was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court saying it was a coercive bait and switch,
right?
We'll get you. We're going to drop any criminal. We're going to drop the criminal investigation. There'll be no criminal charges against you if you testify in the civil case. Then a prosecutor comes back after the fact. I believe it was a new district attorney, and says he made these incriminating statements in the civil case. We're going to use them against him in a criminal case. Supreme Court said coercive bait and switch violation of his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. So all of those admissions would be inadmissible in any future prosecution, and so what do you got? You don't have anything.
You don't have anything. With. That's why I'm wondering why they went through this whole rigmarole, only to do
well
to later find out that what they did was unlawful.
Well, right. I mean, the district attorneys both, but particularly
right.
the one who decided to pursue criminal charges after that deal was in place, they have some explaining to do. That
absolutely.
Was, you know, and frankly, we've seen this before. This is what happens. You think prosecutors are insulated from politics? No, this is what happens mm-hmm. when a prosecutor decides to make a political decision rather than a legal one.
That's right. And the fact that they didn't go forward with the criminal case is really the problem here. So justice wasn't done.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Is the Me Too movement a thing of the past? Has it been supplanted by obsession about race and gender identity? Because, you know, when it was going to be sexual harassment training, I mean, I guess there is still some of that. Not some of that. I guess that still is a thing in the business world.
The training solves everything, Dan. So,
right.
That, you know, if I go through a 2-hour sexual harassment training and somebody signs off that I went to it, then I'm no longer going to sexually harass anybody.
No, right. Of course it is. You know,
well, that's what they did in the Springfield. As the #MeToo movement hit, what did they make us all do? Sexual harassment training. Okay.
This is lawyers running the world. This is checking
exactly.
a box, right?
Yeah.
You know, keep your hands to yourself. Okay, training session dismissed. But it doesn't have the same emphasis that it did prior to the race and gender identity, LGBTQ+.
That's because Trump's not there.
Yeah, okay.
Honestly, right. That's why.
Bill Cosby's representation, wow. You know, I would have just said thank you and slowly slinked away. Not these guys. His spokesman, Andrew Wyatt, it's a beautiful day, not just for Bill Cosby, because this is about all Americans making sure that they get justice. Right. It's a beautiful day, and it's a beautiful day also for women, said Andrew Wyatt, Cosby's spokesman.
You know, he's allegedly these were all false allegations to begin with.
Right. But
so that's why it's a beautiful day for women that he's released.
Well, right.
And what do you think black women think about this, too?
But the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did not say that. They did not say the allegations were without merit. They just said that his Fifth Amendment right was Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination was violated. That's not the same thing as saying you're not guilty.
No, they
of the
actually
underlying
said
accusation.
He is guilty, that he did yes. do this. That the statements were very clear that he did this, but you know, that it was an unlawful procedure.
Verlon so. On the South Side.
Yeah, I got a question. I'm sorry about that. What's up, Dan, and how you doing, Miss Ass?
Very
yeah, that's
good.
Right.
All right. I got a question. Can these prosecutors be sued for prosecutorial misconduct? And he did maintain his innocence. He did admit to drugging the woman, but he said the sex was consensual. So, you know, he's innocent to proving guilty.
Wait, Verlon, help me follow the logic of that. Yes, I drugged them, and then they gave me their consent. That those two things are incongruent.
Well, listen now. You got to keep things in its time. Because back in those days, you know, before us, those people were getting high and partying. Trust me. I watched my father's generation, uncles, they all went through it. They partied and drugged.
Yeah.
So that's a time before us. So it may have happened that way. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, he's innocent until proven guilty. But my original question is, can
he's
the prosecutors
guilty.
Be sued?
Well, they can be sued. I mean, it's tough to pierce the sovereign immunity of public officials, but you can be sued for malicious prosecution. Absolutely, you can. They could be sanctioned by the bar if you wanted to file an ARDC complaint against them. They could even be prosecuted if they did something that was violative of criminal statute. Do I think any of those things are going to happen with respect to the prosecutor, the original, or the district attorney who brought the criminal charges against Cosby? No, I do not.
No, he'll get reelected.
What about the prosecutor that was just doing it for the fame this time around?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The prosecutor who filed the criminal, who moved the criminal case against Cosby, is the one who violated the deal that Cosby mm-hmm. had when he testified in the civil case. So if there was any target, it was going to be the decision to prosecute Cosby criminally in violation of the previous deal. Thanks for the call, Verlon. Dick in Logan Square.
Yeah, Dan, I just wanted to tell you, you did a terrible fat hour.
It was terrible. It was bad. Thank you. I mean, Dick, Russell is more my speed. Hey, Rudy, you're like school on a holiday. No class. Yeah, man. All right, man. Yeah. See, I'm more of a Russell guy than a Fat Albert guy. But here, let me try my Fat Albert one more time, though, for you, Dick, in Logan Square.
You see, man, without the pudding, I'm just another unemployed sexual predator.
How's that? Better?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Was working during the break on refining my Bill Cosby impersonation. Let me try again. Just one more.
Now you will get ready for the Zim Zam and the Babbity Bibbity, and you will take off your clothes like voo and voom and get ready for the most splendiferous pudding pop you have ever seen.
I think I'm getting better.
Gross.
I think it's closer.
It's gross.
Lewis on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Miss Ives.
Hi.
Okay, what I want to say is that they knew what they was doing when they went after Bill Cosby, and they wanted to punish him. Okay,
for all kinds
of good
reasons.
And the reason why I say that is because he was participating in the oldest profession in the world, that's prostitution. But what he was saying that it was consensual sex. Okay, so the way that they did this is that when they want to get you. And they can't get you legally. So what they do is they put you in the system. They put them in the system, and so they got a saying: the wheels of the wheels of justice turn slow.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened. Okay, so they put him in the system. The wheels of justice turn slow. They knew he was going to apply for an appeal, and they knew that. That the time span on this is like 1 to 2 years, you know, to apply for that. So that's 1 to 2 years. He's in there. Okay. Now, the appeal didn't go through. So he applied to the state Supreme Court. That's another 1 to 2 years. Okay. Now he's in there. Okay. So now when it goes to the Supreme Court, they turn around and they look at it and they say, they corrected the decision that was made by the first judge. It was wrong. Okay. So they vacated it. And when they did that, what they did was they also made a statement that he wasn't exonerated. He wasn't exonerated. And so they served two things that they did. They gave him time. He served 3 years in there. He won't get that time back.
Right.
And they also left that question out there that's going to destroy his reputation, you know.
Well,
people don't know.
Lewis, I get it, and I agree that he should have been exonerated based on what I didn't understand was this deal in place by the previous district attorney before he was prosecuted. So I agree that his Fifth Amendment rights were violated and he should have been released. That's not the same thing to say he was innocent. And I don't believe the ends justify the means, but, I mean, do you believe he was guilty of drugging and assaulting those women?
No,
I don't believe
that. And the reason why I say that.
None of the 75 or so, none.
And the reason why I say that is because every time he would have, you know, those women went there and they was looking for him to do something for him, for them, and in return, he did something for them. And he also had them sign a non-disclosure agreement. And then you have to also look at the time span. They didn't turn around and file no complaint about rape, you know, even though, you know, some of them had went past the statute of limitation. He had, 75 women, and not one of them filed a complaint against him. But they was trying to get him, and they knew they couldn't get him, you know, because of him.
Thanks for the call, Lewis. Appreciate it.
Well, you know, I'm sorry you drug a woman. that's a violation right there. That's it, period.
It's pretty straightforward, yeah. I think, actually. Mike in Melrose Park.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Ms. Stives. Hey, I was just thinking it was really odd that this came to be on the same day that Trump went to the border, and we heard zero about that, but lots and lots about COS.
Well, yeah, although, I mean, thanks to the comic, I don't think the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was calibrating its timing on that decision with Trump's activities. But I hear what you're saying. I want to, and just in terms of coverage, the coverage part, not the, you know, the suggestion of any sort of orchestration. I want to get to this other thing, just since we're talking about sexual predation. You know, where is this going to go when it comes to children? Because on the one hand, you have this Washington Post op-ed from a Philadelphia-based writer promoting showing elementary schoolers kinky sexual activity, including as performed on the streets of America during Pride Month. On the other hand, you have Disney star Kyle Massey, who's been charged with a felony after prosecutors said he sent pornographic videos to a 13-year-old girl via Snapchat and text messages. Boy, a lot of Disney stars get caught up with sex-related crimes. Isn't that interesting? So on the one hand, sexualize children, but then you're going to prosecute them when they become, well, sexual predators. I don't know how else to describe it. So what's it going to be?
Well, you know, in Illinois with SB 818, which is the comprehensive sex ed bill that is sitting on the governor's desk right now that he has not signed, it barely passed. It is pornographic. I've seen the material that would align with the national sex education standards. And for example, there's this whole idea that we need to teach high schoolers all about consent, which is exactly what we're talking about with the Bill Cosby case and to some degree. Right. It's all about consent or not consent. So they show these various videos of this is what consent looks like. This is what consent if they say no, no means no. If they're not really into you, this is, yeah, they're not really into you type of language is what they use. And then they have full blown, this is what
so
consent
hip.
Looks like.
Yeah.
It's so hip. But the first vignette in this Planned Parenthood video, by the way, it's a consent video put out by Planned Parenthood. The first vignette is female-female that they're into each other. Okay. And then it shows them go ahead and they push them into like they're groping each other, literally groping each other. Then the next one is male, female, and it's black man, white woman. And they're literally on the bed, you know, just going at it completely. And then the last vignette is male on male, two white males getting it on with each other and all this stuff. And it's extremely explicit. This would comply with the national sex education standards. This is stuff that could be in your high schools. And it's sexual grooming. They are grooming these kids.
Well, I just don't understand. I mean, on the one hand, you have this Lauren Rowella writing that she took her kid to a pride parade, and then a man paused to be playfully spanked by a partner with a flog, and her toddler asked, "What are they doing?" And I had to explain they were too young to, at the time that she writes, they were too young to understand the nuance of the situation, but I told them the truth, that these folks were members of our community celebrating who they are and what they like to do. Exposing children to kink culture to destigmatize sex and break down social boundaries is of what it means to be presentable. This is important. So then why is Kyle Massey being charged with a crime for sending pornographic videos to a 13-year-old girl? Why is that former Disney star? Why is he being charged with a crime? Pornography is something to be celebrated. It's something for toddlers to indulge. It's something to talk about and destigmatize. Well, we can't have it both ways. You can't be charging right. people for the things you say you're instructing them to do, can we?
Especially if you're instructing them to do this in a public school. Because well, yes. the national sex education standards, back to that, I mean, by eighth grade, they are the instruction is about anal and oral sex, according to the standards which are required in this legislation.
Well, I guess we got to
nobody saying anything.
I guess we got to decide what kind of culture we want. Do we want a culture where sending trafficking in child pornography is a criminal offense, or do we want a culture in which trafficking in child pornography is to be celebrated and destigmatized? What's it going to be?
And paid for by taxpayers.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, former state representative and GOP gubernatorial and congressional candidate Jeannie Ives, now the principal of Breakthrough Ideas. Where can people get information on Breakthrough Ideas?
Breakthrough-ideas.com.
And what does Breakthrough Ideas do?
We actually connect the dots on policy for voters so that they can understand it better, because we just can't believe that 51% of the voters in the state of Illinois have bought into crazy.
Well,
we have a hard time believing it. We think they don't know what they don't know. So
yeah, okay.
We're providing pushback in the suburbs as well, organizing some grassroots, especially around the school issues at this point. And we're there to support our conservative youth. And in fact, we have some people going to Dixon, Illinois in July. The Young Americans Foundation, which is the foundation founded by Ronald Reagan, has taken over, or they have control now of Ronald Reagan's boyhood home there. And they are going to start to do youth conferences out there. So this will be their third site. They have the Reagan Ranch in California. They have a Washington, D.C. site. And so now they're going to bring youth around and get them involved in conservative thought earlier.
Very good. Maybe taking a Eureka College football game while they're down there where Reagan played. Tony Fauci on, doing softball interviews with the deep thinkers on CNN. They're celebrating 100 years of Chinese communism, CNN. Tony Fauci on with Don Lamone talking about his concern about the two Americas. The vaccinated America and the unvaccinated America, particularly given the Delta variant threat that looms.
When you have such a low level of vaccination superimposed upon a variant that has a high degree of efficiency of spread, what you are going to see among under-vaccinated regions, be they states, cities, or counties, you're going to see these individual types of blips. It's almost like it's going to be two Americas. You're going to have areas where the vaccine rate is high, where there's more than 70% of the population has received at least one dose. When you compare that with areas where you may have 35% of the people vaccinated, you clearly have a high risk of seeing these spikes in those selected areas. The thing that's so frustrating about this, Don, is that this is entirely avoidable, entirely preventable. If you are vaccinated, you diminish dramatically your risk of getting infected, and even more dramatically, your risk of getting seriously ill. If you are not vaccinated, you are at considerable risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is exactly the argument that they're making right now in the state of Illinois, because they had that outbreak at a camp. 85 campers in central Illinois came down with COVID. One was hospitalized. These are young kids, not typically susceptible. And this is, I think, actually part of the reason that Governor Pritzker felt compelled to extend his mask and his social distancing mandates another 30 days and still take control. He's calling this, and then he walks out with a mask on himself because he's afraid of the Delta variant. My son and I were talking about that. Delta, is that what happened to Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie variants, or is Delta meaning change? We're not sure.
Or is it that it originates in New Orleans?
Oh, that could be it, too.
Yeah, I think
Who
so.
Knows? I mean, the Delta variant, they're making it sound like some scary thing.
85 campers got infected. One was hospitalized, and do we know the status on that one?
We don't know the status on that one. I don't know, but I mean, honestly, this is also his push for vaccination. But Illinois, look, the country, nation as a whole, and Illinois, only 46% are fully vaccinated. This is all about the vaccinations, and it's not about natural immunity at all. That's completely missing from this argument, and the CNN commentator can't even ask those questions.
Well, for more on this, let's talk to an expert in the field, Dr. Chad Savage, founder of Your Choice Direct Care, policy advisor for the Heartland Institute. Dr. Savage, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Gene.
Hi.
So here's the thing with what Tony Fauci is prattling on with his lecturing us, as his want to do. Here's the thing that really rubs me the wrong way about what he said. It has nothing to do with vaccinations, except the lack of context. You're more susceptible if you don't get vaccinated, and sort of the suggestion of dire consequences. And persisting despite everything we know about the threat COVID poses for those, say, 60 and up versus certainly those 18 and younger, which is where we're now really talking about vaccinations. Actually, now we're really talking about 12 and younger, but let's say 18 and younger, school-age kids. He refuses to make a distinction as to the threat presented by the virus based on age and underlying conditions in conversations where he's proselytizing the vaccinations. And it just really is annoying to me because he obviously knows better and he's choosing not to be better.
You know, it's kind of an incredible way they're approaching this. I mean, you're talking about a disease that almost exclusively is dangerous to the elderly, and yet they're perseverating and hyperventilating about children. And if you use by analogy, you know, imagine if you had a disease state that almost exclusively affected children. Would you want to shut down the nursing homes and just obsess on the elderly? No,
yeah,
you would focus
right
on the risk group.
Right.
And that's not what they're doing. You know, there's a lot of consternation and hyperventilating about the Delta variant right now. But, you know, most of that's based on very preliminary data. I mean, the truth is we don't know a lot about it yet, but new data is coming out daily. And the most recent data suggests that a lot of this fervor is probably unwarranted. Initially, you know, the concern is that the Delta is more transmissible, and that actually may be true because it has a higher affinity for the ACE2 receptor, which allows entry of the virus into the body. But there was also a belief that it was at twice the risk for hospitalization. But that's largely been debunked now. Public Health England, which is one of the largest governmental entities to look at this, and England has quite a bit of the Delta variant, looked at 60,000 cases, and they actually found that compared to the other variants, the Gamma, the Lambda, and all the other, you know, the other variants that are out there, actually had the lowest mortality associated with it. So it may be more contagious, but less dangerous. And the same exact groups, elderly are affected. The vaccine, though there was initially some concern that the vaccine may not be effective, and that was probably based on the fact that India initially said that their vaccine, which is a different vaccine, wasn't working. Now, of course, since that original statement, they've come out and said, no, even that vaccine tends to be working. You're talking a difference from a 95% efficacy down to an 88% efficacy. So it's not a big drop in efficacy. But the real issue with the vaccine is, and which they miss all the time, is there's this implicit assumption when they say, well, just get the vaccine, as though there's no consequence
right
from the
right
vaccine itself.
Well, here's the thing.
Okay.
You know, out of an abundance of caution, doctor, we're going to continue with our standard operating procedure, which is to be irrational and hysterical. And if it turns out that our rationality and our hysteria was wrong, then we'll say, out of an abundance of caution, we chose that path. With respect to
never let facts get in the way of a good narrative.
No, good fear-mongering. About the vaccines and now the warning labels the FDA is putting on the vaccines about myocarditis. New study published this week in peer-reviewed JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, cardiology journal, higher than expected number of myocarditis cases among male military members after the second dose of an mRNA vaccine against the COVID virus. Higher than expected number of myocarditis cases. So Right. It's not without consequence, particularly for the young relative to their threat posed by COVID, and particularly perhaps among young men.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, Israel has some of the best data on this, too. And they estimated that the incidence of myocarditis may be as high as 1 in 3,000, which is still rare. But when you're talking about max vaccinations of youth, there are about 75 million children under age 18 in the United States. And if 1 in 3,000 of those were to get myocarditis, that would be 25,000 cases of myocarditis. And understand that in the last 18 months, about 300 children under 18 have actually died. A number of those cases could die or have permanent debility, irregular heart rhythms, and such. So 25,000, when you're doing a risk-benefit analysis, that has to weigh heavily on that calculus.
Well, what do you do if you're, like me, two kids in the military, both of them essentially forced to get the vaccine? It seems nonsensical. Another one of my sons, you know, headed to college, and again, University of Chicago forcing kids, students to get the vaccine, and yet they're not forcing their more elderly faculty and administration to get the vaccine. I mean, I don't know why we're still having this conversation when there's so much more data out there about natural immunity, yeah. You know, and the risk factors, and I'm very frustrated by it all. My kids did not want to get the vaccine in the military, and they did, and they're getting, and you know, you've had this whole blow up at West Point with unvaccinated versus vaccinated cadets getting treated differently, and it's going to happen in schools if we don't do something more now.
Oh, absolutely, and it may be to great harm, and OSHA and other rules have changed to absolve those who make those mandates of legal responsibility. OSHA just recently said that if you're an employer and you mandate vaccinations for your employee, that's no longer considered a workplace injury where previously it would have been considered. So it's interesting because the government is saying we're not mandating vaccines, and yet they're changing the rules every way they can so that you can have a mandate without directly having a mandate. Well, you don't have to get the vaccine. It's not governmentally mandated, but you just can't go to school or work or go to sporting events or otherwise engage in your life. But we're not mandating.
And I'm also confused about something else. So the WHO says the vaccinated should wear masks, and the CDC says the vaccinated don't have to wear masks, even with the specter of the Delta variant. So what's an American to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the so-called experts can't make up a decision, I think that means that you're right to make your own decision.
We can't do that. No. Somebody has to make the decision for me. I am not a sovereign person. I am a ward of the state. So I need my parents to figure out their disagreement.
Yeah. And actually, if you look at, we were talking about myocarditis cases, and the FDA recently, you know, looked at that. If you look at their paper that they created, where they said, no, this is okay to continue vaccinating youth. When they tried to say the vaccine is still vastly more beneficial than harmful, they did a apple to oranges comparison where they compared presumed from a model which used numbers assuming that the highest level of COVID in the community is going to continue for forever, and it's already at the lowest levels it's been since the start of the pandemic. So they make a false assumption right off the bat when they create their model, what they would presume hospitalizations would be from not vaccinating, and they compare it to presumed cases of myocarditis using the lower numbers. Again, like you mentioned with the cadets, they're probably higher than that. And so they compared hospitalizations from not vaccinating to presumed myocarditis from vaccinating, which again isn't even comparing the same thing. These are such basic, elementary errors in an assessment that you have to wonder, were they truly that incompetent as to consider those equivalent things? In which case, if they are, we shouldn't be listening to them. Or was there some malevolence in the creation of this? Are they intentionally trying to just simply support a narrative no matter what the actual data is showing? And I have no idea what the rationale for that would be.
Yeah, you do have to wonder, don't you? Dr. Chad Savage, founder of Your Choice Direct Care, policy advisor to the Heartland Institute as well. Dr. Savage, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And you joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch.
and it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Discussion of the condo building collapse in Surfside, Florida. And, of course, the desire is to assign responsibility. Whose fault was it? And maybe it's all of our faults. That seems to be what some Biden administration officials are suggesting, that the possibility of climate change was the cause of the building collapse. Remarkable. But here is the remarkable Jennifer Granholm. She's she's our energy secretary. No, I'm not kidding. She was actually a governor of Michigan. Seriously. I know you think I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. It's true.
Do you think that climate could have played a role in that building's collapse?
Well, obviously we don't know fully, but we do know that, the seas are rising. I mean, we know that we're losing inches and inches of beaches, not just in Florida, but all around. You know, Lake Michigan, where I'm from, they, you know, we've seen the loss of beaches because the waters are rising.
Wait,
you
know, a minute.
I live right next to Lake Michigan and Lake Point Tower. Maybe I should be calling for an evacuation.
Why don't you have a structural engineer in there as well? Okay, here's the deal on the rising of Lake Michigan water. Okay, so 2020, they put out this alarmist thing. Okay, highest level of water that you've ever seen. Well, 6 years ago, prior to that, it was the lowest level, and they were worried about Lake Michigan draining itself.
Well,
it's ridiculous.
Well, here's the thing. And then she went on to flack for the infrastructure bill. With the infrastructure bill, are we going to build private condo buildings? What the hell are you talking about? Peter Ducey, Fox News, followed up with EPA Administrator Michael Regan yesterday on the very topic of what the Secretary Granholm had to say. And here's what EPA Administrator Michael Regan had to say.
Do you agree with the Energy Secretary Granholm that it's possible the Surfside condos collapse may be a result of climate change?
You know, I don't know if we have enough information at this point. You know, what I'll say is EPA, both our headquarters and our regional offices, are coordinating with the state of Florida and folks in that region to really understand what's happening on the ground and be sure that we're deploying adequate resources to keep those actions safe for those folks.
Whatever that means. Okay. Can't rule out climate change. Well, some of the details coming out from condo association correspondence with contractors. About 3 years ago, engineers noted design flaws and failing waterproofing that would lead to their, quote, exponential damage, unquote, in the Champlain Towers South condominium complex. Documents include an unverified 40-year inspection report that had been received 16 hours after the building's catastrophic failure, and correspondence from the condo association to contractors about spalling, cracking concrete, and other visible structural damage that may indicate more substantial damage that is unseen but couldn't be identified until you actually got into a full and complete inspection. For more on this, the engineering piece of it, let's try to stick to what we know as opposed to throwing out ridiculous theories, as is happening from a lot of quarters, frankly. Embarrassing. Pleased to be joined by Professor Gong Kang Fu. He's a professor of civil and architectural engineering at IIT. Professor Fu, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, based on what we know from what has been put into the public domain about the condo association management of the building, the inspections that had been done, and some of the initial reviews of professionals in the space that were being contracted or that were in the process of getting contracted by the condo association to do repairs to the building. They were going to do a $15 million special assessment to do these repairs to the building. Is there anything obvious to you that somebody should have seen or known something that would have indicated or that indicated to them, or should have indicated to them, that there was something catastrophic that was possible at any moment. It was, is something obvious that people overlooked that shouldn't have been overlooked?
Well, it doesn't seem to be the case based on the public information so far. Yes, some issues were identified in that 2018 inspection report. However, no timeline was given, and I don't know if anyone would be able to give that timeline as to what might happen next and when, and particularly in this case, the collapse of the entire building. I don't think anybody would have been able to. So that's what I see so far. But sometime down the road, there might be more things coming up, you know, to tell us, to answer that question.
And one of the other, you know, and this is sort of anecdotal from residents and so forth, but you know, perhaps this is something that repeats itself over and over when you're talking about buildings of this size and close together with one another. We're talking about beachfront property. But residents saying recent construction at a nearby building was having an effect on their units. Some of the units, they noticed cracking in the walls and other such damage being done to their condos that the building was shifting, and they attributed it to the construction that was going on nearby. Is that a possibility that could have exacerbated whatever structural infirmities existed in the building?
I guess right now nothing is impossible, but we don't have adequate data to tell us that is what happened. Let's face it, if you are nearby a large construction site, you would feel something. How many times did we feel that it's hazardous, it's even dangerous? We probably didn't. So, however, for this case, such a catastrophe has happened, so I don't think the government agencies would exclude anything at this point. If I understand it correctly, based on what I've read, the National Institute of Standards and Technologies is involved. It's a government agency that has the responsibility to investigate such incidents.
Well, and they do these 40-year, you know, any building that's 40 years old in Florida has a required inspection that must be recertified for electrical and structural safety after 40 years. And this building was built in 1980 or 81, so it was right here for their 40-year inspection. But the question is, you know, is there, again, any reason now, not on the condo side, the management side, but on the regulatory side, the government side, is there anything obvious that inspectors didn't do that they should have done that could have caught this before, obviously, the collapse happened?
I don't see right now, as far as the public information goes. On the other hand, as a structural engineer myself, licensed to perform such work possibly, I think that 40 years is too long.
40 years is too long. The recertification should be in a shorter time frame, you're saying?
Correct. To catch such possible defects. And apparently, for this case, they are within... the building is within that 40-year limit, and it has collapsed.
Is there an industry standard, or do you see states that have a shorter time frame that you suggest should be replicated? Is there a magic number?
Well, I have a reference for bridges. We do every 2 years inspection.
For bridges, okay.
It's a very variable situation. You know, city by city, they have different requirements.
Right, but I mean, is there a best practice, as you suggest, when it comes to, you know, multi-story condo buildings?
Not to my immediate knowledge at this point. I'm pretty sure the profession will, you know, the profession of civil engineers and structural engineers will get into this case and get down to the bottom, and hopefully there will be some national standards coming up as a result of this incident.
So how does this work? How does your profession dictate to the on-the-ground building inspector exactly what to look for and what the standards are, should be? I mean, that's where it should come from. I'm a little bit confused that there aren't clear standards already.
We as a profession, meaning structural engineers, do not make that decision. However, the policy-making agencies or government offices from time to time consult us, getting the professional opinions into these codes. So these codes officially are adopted by government, just like this case. I think it is the city or maybe the state. I didn't get exactly what that body might be. That said, 40 years is the interval. And as far as I'm concerned, that interval is too long. Within 40 years, many things can happen.
Well, it appears to me in this, you know, I'm looking at some of the pictures of what appears, apparently the Wall Street Journal had a big article on this. And, I mean, are we back to if you see something, say something? Because some of this stuff looks pretty obvious as needing to be inspected. And certainly the residents and the condo board were kind of discussing this, especially after the 2018 report. It just feels like people failed to take it any further. It reminds me also, Dan, of the bridge that I believe it was over Lakeshore Drive, and they shut down everything because there was visible chunks falling off of the bridge.
Right.
And so, I mean, are we all inspectors now? Or I don't understand the gap here between a building inspector actually not catching this.
I actually commented on that Lakeshore Drive northbound incident when it happened on a couple of TV stations. And for bridges, we inspect them every 2 years. And some of them actually are inspected more frequently, depending on the situation. So, fortunately, for that particular case, it was caught and nobody got hurt. And for this building situation, apparently, the devastating condition was not caught in time and addressed in time, and that's why we saw this catastrophe and such a significant loss of lives.
Yeah, I mean, the condo board president writing to relative to her letter to an engineer named Frank Morabito, it's impossible to know the extent of the damage to the underlying rebar until the concrete is opened up. Oftentimes the damage is more extensive than can be determined by inspection of the surface. So they see surface indications of structural damage that they were moving to try to correct, perhaps obviously not as quickly as they should have, but I mean, the question is, was it reasonable for them to have known that at the time in over the last 3 years? And that seems to be an open question. I wonder if, people have talked about the punishment that a building takes and the structural integrity of a building takes from, you know, being that close to the ocean and the seawater. Anything with respect to how buildings are built, the foundation of buildings, how deep they go down with the pylons and so on and so forth. I mean, are those areas of inquiry that are that should be pursued as well?
Of course. You wouldn't expect HOA president or board members to be able to answer these structural engineering related questions.
Right.
Right.
So, which means the government really should have something more specific. Just like, for example, again, bridge engineering. we have volumes and pages of specifications for engineers to follow, which would not be even possible for people without engineering background to understand. Apparently, for buildings, there is no such information available, even for engineers to refer to.
Well, the only thing, the thing that's interesting here, though, is you have this sister building built by the same developer that's, you know, right across the way. And despite some of the hysteria, like this is some sort of contagion and people should evacuate that building too, people aren't evacuating that building because there's not an indication that there's any problem with the structural integrity there. So it just seems to me you've almost got twins located next to each other. This happened to the one building. It didn't happen to the other building. There's got to be something unique or a unique series of variables that occurred that were in play with respect to the building that collapsed versus the other one. That's why, you know, trying to get to that. I'm not suggesting that anybody has that answer at point, but I'm just saying, you know, this seems to me where the investigation should be directed.
Are you referring to Tower North, Dan?
Right.
Because the
right. This is Champlain South, and there's a north one, right?
Yeah. If I would be the resident in there, I would get out immediately.
Why?
Because there are so many unknowns at this point, which could cause Tower North to collapse anytime.
Well,
as far as I'm concerned.
Well, but I mean, the only unknown, I guess, with respect to Tower North would be whether or not the cause of the collapse of Tower South was shoddy construction or a shoddy laying of a foundation, right?
But possibly that Tower North shares the same foundation as Tower South.
Yeah.
I don't know that.
Right.
Well, quite a few residents are fleeing.
Being so close.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, being so close, you really have to play safe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But let me put it this way, you know, let's say in city of Chicago, you see these buildings next to each other, right? Right. I mean, on the street, let's say Michigan Avenue, mm-hmm. right? If you are in one building and the your next neighbor's building has collapsed, what would you do? I mean, it may come to your building any minute, as far as I'm concerned, as a structural engineer.
Hmm.
Well, it appears that one particular resident says that the building is going to be the safest building in Surfside and in Florida because we're the twin sister to Champlain South. We have engineers coming here every day to use our building as a comparison for the one that collapsed. So residents are making their individual decisions whether to stay or go, it appears.
Yeah, they make their own decisions. Of course, I respect
yes.
that.
Mm-hmm.
For your own safety, I would move out immediately. And I would never get back into that building until somebody gives me a piece of paper saying that building is safe from an authority.
Mm. All right.
And promising to cover whatever the damage that might come. And I'm not going to put my life there.
I'm with you.
He is Gong Kang Fu. He's a professor of civil and architectural engineering at IIT. Professor Fu, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day. Then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former state rep and GOP gubernatorial and congressional candidate Jeannie Ives. Now principal of Breakthrough Ideas, breakthrough-ideas.com. And, Jeannie, I'm a big fan of Judson University in Elgin. Anybody who's listened
nice.
To the show knows
I've been
that.
There. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've met the president. Mm-hmm.
And participated in some of the speaking events they've had over the years in their World Leaders Forum.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a little confused about this upcoming conversation with Mark Vargas, the subject that is sort of inside the actor studio this time is Terrence Howard. Why am I confused? Because Judson University is a Christian university. And this is who Terrence Howard is. Terrence Howard on Jussie Smollett, that French actor, was on Empire, after his alleged hate crime incident.
Jussie's the one that starts singing when everybody's in a bad mood. You know, he's the one that cheers everybody up. He's the one that does all the Instagrams if he catches you sleeping. You know, he's going to, you know, today no one was caught sleeping. Yeah, no one even took time to close their eyes and nap. They were all in shock that our family, you know, the Fox family, the Empire family, the Lion family, you know, was attacked by a bunch of hyenas today.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. And he continued to defend Jussie Smollett long after it became clear that it was a hoax. I mean, he may continue to this day. He went on to say at some point, his innocence, Smollett's, or judgment is not for any of us to decide. Stay in your lane, and my lane is empathy and love and compassion, is it? Well, the same Terrence Howard in 2017 said that punching his ex-wives, punching plural, ex-wives plural, were terrible mistakes, plural. And then after he said that, he went on to say that there's a double standard society has toward abusive women who feel that they can assault a man and not reap what they have sowed. So it doesn't sound like he was that sorry after all. When I say I've made mistakes, it's not regarding violence, but judgment, trusting the wrong people. So he's not sorry about hitting women, it would seem. Should be a spirited conversation. I don't know if you'll have time to get into Crash and all of Terrence Howard's movies. For more on this, Mark Vargas, host of Mark My Words on AM 560, Sunday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., and host of the ongoing series at Judson University known as Conversations with Mark Vargas. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Jeannie. How are you?
Good morning. So, you know, I'm happy to go through Terrence Howard's filmography, and I have appreciated some of his movies. He's a talented actor. But he also doesn't seem to be a very good person, and so I wonder how that conversation is going to proceed.
Sure. Well, for starters, I mean, no one, you know, I'm chairman of Judson's board of World Leaders Forum, and no one condones violence, physical
Terrence
domestic
does.
Abuse. We don't condone that at all. But listen, let he who has not sinned cast the first stone. This is going to be an issue that we're going to be talking about. Obviously, it's something that we're going to address. I've spoken with Terrence about it personally several times, and it's going to be an issue. We're going to air everything. We're going to be talking about his upbringing, very difficult upbringing. We're going to be talking about a little bit about his film career. We're going to be talking about we're going to be addressing this issue as well, and we're also going to be really talking about what's next for Terrence. Is it film? Is it what other projects is he involved in? And what a lot of people also don't realize is Terrence has nearly 70 patents to his name, and he's working on some really innovative technologies. But we're going to cover hard topics. We're going to cover emotional topics. It's going to be a wide ranging discussion, and I'm not certainly going to be holding back in any way, shape, or form. All of these issues are very important address.
When he gives you the pro forma, I had an abusive father line in response to his abusing women. Just ask him a simple question, if you would, or maybe you can, you know, just attribute it to me. I'll be the first question from the audience. If you're suggesting that that's causal, you were abused by your father, he was a violent man, so that's why you're violent towards women, then you'll have to explain to me why other children who were in abusive households, abused by their fathers, don't abuse women and don't do it serially and then don't condone it after they suggest that they don't condone it. So, I mean, I would like to, like, a full, and this would be great because it would be newsmaking for you, a real dive on this with respect to Terrence Howard, because I don't know about you, but I tire of celebrities or people in the public eye getting away with, I was a victim, so it's okay to victimize others.
Listen, no one's looking for excuses, and we all have very different upbringings, and obviously we're all responsible for our own actions. But I think that people are going to walk away. I am confident that people are going to walk away with a different perspective of Terrence. And that's going to be the goal of our conversations. And yes, it's going to be a little bit controversial, and I want that. And I'm not necessarily wanting to bring I want controversial people as part of my speaker series. Listen, we got some controversy with Mark Cuban, obviously. And Dan, sure. I do hope you're going to be there. I missed having you at the Mark Cuban event. I was waiting for your question. I had that all teed up.
Well, I was
looking for you, and I couldn't find you.
I was going to go, but I was wearing my free Hong Kong T-shirt, and I know that offends Mark Cuban, so I couldn't get in.
Well, and you know, and Terrence is coming out for free because he knows that all the proceeds from my speaker series are supporting three very important scholarship verticals. One is entrepreneurship, two is diversity, and three is a new one, Judson's Rise program, which only 5% of all colleges and universities in the United States offer a program for students with intellectual disabilities. Many of those students have Down syndrome. And so the money that we're going to be raising is going to help fund student scholarships. The scholars will be there, so you get to see them in person. You get to meet them. You get to see your investment in real time. And it's going to be July 9th. You can find tickets at judsonu.edu/WLF conversations. And there's a special promo code, FILM, F-I-L-M, and it will drop the ticket price by $20 from $75 to $55. But again, this is going to be a real engaging conversation. As you know, Dan, I'm never one to shy away from controversial topics or controversial figures. This is going to be an interesting conversation.
Mark, so Judson University is a member of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. And so I'm curious, do you know, does Terrence Howard have a faith life?
Terrence does have a faith life, and he certainly has addressed some of these things, some of it publicly, but we'll be talking about this again during my event. And I wanted to be clear, you know, the World Leaders Forum in my speaker series is a separate entity. It's a 501c3 under, so it's not a Judson affiliated program. So it's separate, and that allows for my speaker series to bring in a little bit more controversial figures. But again, people are going to walk away with a much different perspective on Terrence, and I can guarantee that just on the questions that we're going to be addressing.
Will Subway be catering the event by any chance? You see what I did there? A little Jesse Smollett thing. But all right, Mark Vargas, host of Mark My Words, AM 560, Sunday evening, 7 to 9 p.m. The series, Conversations with Mark Vargas, Terrence Howard, July 9th. Go to judson.edu for tickets. And what's that promo code again?
It's FILM, F-I-L-M.
All right, FILM is the promo code. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Terrific.
Thanks so much.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and in for Amy J this morning, former state rep Jeannie Ives. And Jeannie, your take on this whole Gwen Berry matter, this U.S. track athlete. There's calls now from members of Congress to have her removed from the Olympic team because she, you know, turned away from the flag during a medal ceremony and raised up a T-shirt, athlete activist, and she's got all kinds of nonsensical things to say about racism and American stuff. You know, sort of like Colin Kaepernick.
I think
the female
people,
Colin Kaepernick.
They always get what's coming to them. So, I mean, she's not going to perform well, in my opinion. This is a distraction, and I really don't care to give her any more press over it.
Yeah, that's sort of what my take is, too. I this whole idea, like, we rush to something when people behave boorishly, we rush to not let them behave boorishly. No, let them behave boorishly. Yeah. Let her just be another classless ignoramus who makes a spectacle of herself. If she gets rich, which she probably will, thanks to Nike or corporate America generally, well, fine. But the more attention you give to her, the more money she's going to make from corporate America being anti-American. By contrast, this was great in this whole controversy. Somebody found this clip. Usain Bolt, not an American, Jamaican, during an interview at the 2012 games in London. Listen to what Usain Bolt, the fastest man in the world, does.
It was all about business today. I came out to defend my title, and that's what I did.
You came here to be a legend. You are already a legend.
Could we cut the interview? Is it live?
Yeah, okay. So, yes, Last Dance.
National
Anthem. Ah, sorry, sorry. El himno nacional.
Just so you understand, he cut the interview short because the national anthem was being played. He's Jamaican. He didn't put his hand over his heart, but he stood out of respect at attention to the playing of the anthem rather than continuing to that interview. So Usain Bolt proves himself to be a class act on the international stage. And if Gwen Berry wants to prove herself to be a classless act, why should we not let her? Why does that say something about America rather than just something about Gwen Berry?
Yeah.
You know?
And her upbringing, by the way.
Oh, you
truthfully.
Mean, well, yeah, sure. But I mean, I just don't.
I always wonder what the parents are like.
Sure.
Quite frankly.
Yeah. Although sometimes, you know.
Yeah, they would not be coming to Thanksgiving dinner if my kids did that stuff.
Your kids would not?
They wouldn't do that.
They would
stuff.
Not. Well, obviously.
First of all, but no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're all like trained killers.
What else do you want out of your kids?
How many are West Point?
Well, I've got one in right now, and one is a graduate, but right. He's a traitor because he went to the Navy, but we still allow him around.
Wow.
He's a Navy pilot.
You serve the Navy in the Ives family, and you're called a traitor. That's how tough it is.
Well, while we're on the Ives family, I do have to give a shout-out
yes.
to Andrew. Happy 25th birthday today, Andrew.
All right.
And
he's the candy ass that's in accounting. As
yes,
to
yes,
the military.
Absolutely. But, you know, he's not a candy ass. He also rivals you, Dan, as he was caddy of the year.
Yeah, he caddied for me one time when I played Chicago golf. This was a few years ago. He's a good caddy.
Oh,
I don't know
yeah.
if he's as good as I was in my prime. Not now, but in my prime. But he's a good caddy.
I'm he's sure, a great kid.
I'm sure he'll
he's
work
your
out.
Classic middle child. Just love that guy to death.
I'm sure he'll work out. Well, happy 25th, Andrew. Quickly, Mike on the north side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Jeannie. I still have your bumper sticker on my locker at work at the city. Everybody sees it when they come in. I say, that's our next governor when we get rid of fat ass. I wanted to say about engineering, usually there's two different engineering reports. There's there's an inspection by the government, and there's an inspection by who's ever financing the builder. I knew a guy that did this for high-rises downtown, and a building built four stories more than they were zoned for.
Mike,
two, they sold off at enormous profits, and two were given to politicians.
You're scaring Dan now.
Well, we're up against it, but I appreciate the call, Mike.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I found the perfect gift for Mayor Triple Threat. If people want to chip in, I'm thinking about starting a GoFundMe. Peabody. He lives in San Diego, California. Peabody is so small he could never live outside unless he gets bigger. We're not sure he will, according to miniature horse trainer Faith Smith. Six-wheel Peabody is allegedly the world's tiniest horse. And so you get Triple
That's
Threat
perfect.
Peabody, and then she can ride around the city with the census cowboy.
But only she can ride it. Her wife can't.
No. No, only she or other mayors of Chicago who are similarly sized, which is all of them. All the miniature Marxists. The Marxist Munchkins. I want to see, and I haven't contacted Faith Smith yet, if she has other miniature horses, because then I could get two more, and then it could be...
You'd have a posse.
Well, yeah, it could be like Chevy Chase, Martin Short, and Steve Martin. the three amigos. On their miniature horses, except it would be three amigos who are also Munchkin Marxists, who are mayors of Chicago, current or recently passed. Daily, Emmanuel, and Lightfoot, and the Census Cowboy riding around town. How much fun that would that be? That'd be a great Western. Or at least
isn't it
Western
John
spoof.
John Logan on a horse? Isn't that statue in Chicago? It's John Logan on a horse, so we'll put Lightfoot on her horse.
What you mean to
as a statue
to replace?
Yes, yes. Well, he's on this. He's actually one of the replacement statues. The list of 41 that are a problem, apparently.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and maybe this will get, if I offer this to Triple Threat, you know, maybe I need a little help.
I'm in. I'll donate
$10. You'll donate to the GoFundMe page? Yeah. Maybe she'll treat me the way that she treats Phil Ponce and come on the show and talk to us about all the wonderful things she's doing. She was on with Phil Ponce, who I guess just announced he's retiring. Does anybody know who that is? Probably not. he's on Wilmette Talking to Winnetka, that PBS station here. He does a show at night, and now apparently he's not going to do it. I don't know. Is he joining his sons in that a cappella group? I don't know. Straight No Chaser. Maybe he's going to embark on a singing career, which would be great. And I actually like Phil. He's a nice guy, but he's, you know, standard issue supplicant to the 100%. Political class. You know, you've been on Chicago Tonight a million times with them. Standard issue, you know, come on, just fall in line like I do, kind of questioning. Yeah. Well, that's what he did with Lightfoot when he posed this question to her in a recent interview, talking about, in part, her record on public safety and the criticism she's receiving for the lack thereof in Chicago.
Mayor, in recent months, there have been questions raised about your temperament and your reaction to criticism. Tribune editorial used the term irascible. How much of this do you think might have to do with the fact that you're a woman, and specifically a black woman?
About 99% of it.
Expand on that.
Well, I mean, look at my predecessors. Did people say that Rich Daley held... tea sessions with people that he didn't disagree on. Rahm Emanuel was a polite guy who was a uniter. No. Women and people of color are always held to a different standard. I understand that. I've known that my whole life. And the Tribune or whoever can write what they want. What I'm doing is fighting for the residents of the city. I'm an advocate. I'm going to continue fighting. Obviously, we need to be focused on uniting people as much as we can. But I was elected and ran on disrupting the status quo. And when you disrupt the status quo, you are going to make people uncomfortable. You are going to have people criticize you. But I know where my North Star is. I know the things that we need to be working on. But I absolutely understand that the critics, some of them who are out there, are criticizing me because they don't like to see a woman assume power and forge ahead on an agenda that is about disrupting the status quo. Sorry if I offend people by fighting for what people elected me to do, which is disrupt the machine, disrupt the status quo, and make city government more responsive to the residents.
Did you get the motif there? In case it was sort of put squarely between your eyes, so you'd have to be pretty obtuse to not receive it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. The reason you're criticizing Mayor Lightfoot, if you are, is because you're afraid of a strong black woman on the fifth floor. That's really what's going on here, isn't it? Be honest, isn't it? But and if you ask a question that way, then you have to say yes.
Dan, this is how she likes to describe herself. This is how she got elected.
Right.
Those attributes.
Triple threat. Yeah.
That's right.
Black, female, lesbian. I'm the triple threat. She said that. I called her the triple threat. People say, why are you calling her name? I'm not calling her name. She called herself that. She said, this is all I am. I'm my skin color, my sexual orientation, and my gender. That's all I am.
So it was a benefit to get elected, but once you're in office, it becomes a liability.
Well, it's still a benefit. She's saying it's a liability so as to say, well, you can't criticize me because any criticism of me, 99%, you heard her say, well, is because I'm black and female.
Well, anytime I talk about Lori Lightfoot, I preface it with racist Lori Lightfoot because she won't interview people like you.
Well, she won't let you interview people
like her.
That was for one day. You know, she's back to allowing white people to
ask her questions. So you can be racist one day out of the year?
You can, yes.
Okay.
Apparently, if you're triple threat or if you're an identitarian, you can, and you will, and you should only take compliments from white people, not criticisms, or from anybody, but particularly white people, I think, is her position. So you can ask me questions as long as they're complimentary, which is not a problem for the Chicago Press Corps. So she really doesn't have a problem, even with Phil Ponce there. So it's great. He just sets up the he sets the table for her, and she comes in and serves.
And he doesn't push back at all. Of course not.
Of course not. What's to push back on? It's obvious that all the criticism of Lori Lightfoot is based on her gender and her race, and maybe throwing her orientation too, since she's a triple threat. So two things there. One is she's shaking up the status quo, and that's making enemies. Two is anybody who criticizes her is a bigot of some sort. So those two value propositions she advanced, and I guess by extension her value, disrupting the status quo and being an identitarian, having those diverse attributes. That's not about right. So let me understand something. The argument was we didn't say that or that Rahm Emanuel wasn't polite or Richie Daley had a temper. Yeah, I know. But they were criticized for those things. Tiny Dancer was criticized for being a hot-headed little guy with a big Napoleonic complex and not much of a record for being the tough guy coming to town to shake things up, just like she said she's going to be the tough lady coming to town to shake things up, and none of that happened. In point of fact, if you remember Triple Threat, Tiny Dancer had to don the cardigan and do his Mr. Rogers routine for his reelection campaign. I know I've rubbed people the wrong way. I'm sorry. It's going to be a kinder, gentler Tiny Dancer in term two. He had to do that because he rubbed people the wrong way, because he was all hat and no cattle, because he was a bloviating simp and covered his incompetence with false bravado just like you are. And he was criticized for that. Criticized so much that combined with covering up the Laquan McDonald shooting, he couldn't run for re-election, and that gave you your chance to be exactly him, but the black female lesbian version of him. And he was basically the Jewish version of the Irish Richie Daley before him. This has been 35 years of uninterrupted Marxist munchkin incompetence. Has it not?
Well, apparently that's what the residents want, Dan. I mean, that's what it looks like, at least. Crime problem's not solved. Money problem is not solved. Education problem not solved. Chicago's a mess. It's getting worse.
Kristen McQueary, soon to be formerly of the Chicago Tribune, is on the line. Kristen.
Good morning. I needed to respond to this conversation because I was the author of that editorial. I'm also a woman. I am not a black woman, but the idea that the criticism of her is based on her gender is just wrong. And we address that in the editorial. And we also have criticized in the past exactly what you're saying, Rahm Emanuel and his temper and Mayor Daley. And the issue is not, the issue is that you become ineffective when you are a poor communicator, which is what she has shown to be. So I just needed to offer that up. The idea that that question was even posed to her seems a little silly. And we addressed that exact issue, that this is not because she is a female leader. There are other black female leaders who also have discussed her poor communication skills, including the alderwoman she got in an argument with on the council floor, who's also another black woman. So,
excuse me, Miss McQueary, if I could don my Phil Ponce hat for a minute. Mayor Triple Threat addressed that, addressed the Tribune editorial, and she said, consider the source, you know, a bunch of white people over at that Chicago Tribune editorial board. That's not diverse. That doesn't represent the city. And so just consider the source. How do you respond to that?
Well, we are not an all-white editorial board, first of all, and just she has come to be ineffective in what she's trying to accomplish, and it is in part because of her her abrasiveness and her defensiveness and everything that we addressed in the editorial. So I would say go back and read the whole thing. We're very specific on where her ability to get her agenda passed is being held up by her inability to build relationships, and it just becomes an ineffective issue, not a race issue, and not a woman issue.
And would you? And I know you don't know the answer to this, but would you guess that would it be 99% or 100% of the Chicago Tribune editorial board, staff, delivery people voted for Lori Lightfoot?
I don't know the answer to that, Dan. I'm addressing.
Yes, I know.
The editorial
I
wrote.
It was a rhetorical question. Yes, but yeah, she did. She was going right after. She was going specifically after that editorial and suggesting that's a good example of what she's talking about. 99% of the criticism is because she's black and female.
She's got no friends in Springfield, though, either. She didn't get any of her agenda passed in Springfield, and in fact, she didn't get the bad bill stopped, like the enhanced pension bill that went through. The school board, the elected school board. She's completely ineffective.
I mean, that's addressed in the piece, too. She couldn't even get the Black Caucus. So if this is a Black issue, the Black Caucus did not support her on elected school board, on that firefighter pension sweetener, mm-hmm. on enhancing the right of CTU to strike basically yep. now for any reason. The first version of the casino bill that came out of Springfield needed to be rewritten. So it just at some point tying everything to the fact that she's black and a woman it needs to be batted down because it's just not true.
Krista McQuarrie, will you go in with us on the horsey from San Diego for her? Maybe that'll lighten her up.
It is a really cute little miniature pony.
Peabody. Yeah. Lori and Peabody yeah. walking down Michigan Avenue with the census cowboy. I can see it now like the Cisco Kid.
It'll be the cutest meme they've done so far.
Would you think it'd be better than? Thanks for calling. Joining
That's
us,
a re-election postcard.
I don't know. I don't know if it's more endearing
with the green hat.
Do you think that's more endearing than the Rona Busters? Her and Allison Arwadi.
Oh God, that was a good one too. Everything's a caricature here.
I'm
a joke.
I just have my fingers crossed. I want to get invited to the Rona Busters
Halloween party.
No, Lollapalooza.
Oh.
Their VIP tent.
Maybe you'll find a $250 gift card too, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a gimmick all day long.
Open Chicago. Did I win?
You went on a search. I know you.
Oh,
you
yeah.
were bar crawling for a $250 gift card.
Absolutely. Because it's fun.
Did you even go into a grocery store? That'd be the first time in a decade.
Isn't this great?
Such a joke.
We're having so much fun. And crime is down. I heard that from her too. Charlotte in Arlington Heights.
Hi. It just gets so tiring to hear this mayor over and over again. When are we going to do what Martin Luther King had a dream about doing, judge people by the content of their character and not the color of their skin? Mm-hmm. Why
That's a dog whistle now. That's considered a dog whistle.
By the critical race theorists?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Black Lives Matter organization? All right,
Martin Luther
thank
King.
You.
Martin Luther, thanks for the call, Charlotte. Martin Luther King has been replaced by Ibram Kendi. So just think about that, and then remind yourself of the fallacy that the most recent point in time is the most advanced point in history. Because in some respects, technologically, that's true. In a lot of respects, culturally, intellectually, it's not. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Good morning, Jamie. Morning, Dan. You know what it is? It's just so exhausting that these politicians, whenever they're failing in their jobs, they point to race. Oh, you're a racist because you don't believe in this. Whenever you don't believe in their policies or they're doing a bad job, everybody's a racist. When is this going to end? When are they going to live up to what they're supposed to be doing and protecting the people in their cities and doing the right thing for everybody? I just don't understand it.
Thanks for the call, Rich. When is it going to end?
When voters wake up.
When there's a consequence to it.
That's right.
When you don't get a benefit from race hustling. So when that ends, then what you're hearing from Triple Threat and other race hustlers will end. And not until then.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, former state rep and GOP gubernatorial and congressional candidate Jeannie Ives. And Jeannie, we talked about this case yesterday, but it bears more discussion. This is a federal lawsuit filed by Evanston Skokie District 65 drama teacher Stacey DeMar, because if you haven't listened to the show, then maybe you don't know until now. Maybe you don't know because we've covered it a lot. Evanston Skokie District 65 is one of the worst school districts in the country, full stop, period. Yep. And in addition to that, it is also the one of the school districts that was at the tip of the spear in adopting a racist critical race theory curriculum, as well as all the other Marxist deconstructionist aspects of that curriculum, including the sexualization of young children and so forth. And some of the things that are recounted in the suit include directing teachers to participate in racially segregated affinity groups, instructing students to read the book Not My Idea, in which a devil approaches the main character with a contract binding you to whiteness. In the pre-K through second grade, teachers are instructed to ask children, what is your understanding of whiteness? Fourth grade teachers asking students how whiteness showed up in a political cartoon. Fifth grade teachers instructed to preface the book with a statement about white people playing a big role in the problems of racism today and throughout world history. The statement that pretending not to see color is called colorblindness, and colorblindness helps racism. Just a smattering of what was going on, what is going on in Evanston Skokie District 65. And apparently this teacher, Stacey DeMar, wanted to teach drama and not, you know, be a critical race propagandist slash
hustler
consultant. Yes, right. So she filed suit. And here's the thing that's important about this suit on a number of levels, but one level we didn't get to yesterday, and Jeannie, I know you can address this too. These school boards, just like corporate America, school districts, and by extension the school boards, just like corporate America, they're run by the lawyers. It's the abundance of caution crowd. If there's the prospect of a lawsuit, then we have to run in the opposite direction. So whoever is the most irrational and threatening is who gets served, just like whoever is the most frightened is who gets served when it comes to COVID-related policy. And so it's important that a teacher like Ms. DeMar step up, and others like her, to say, hey, if you think this is just about insulating yourself from litigation and you're going to get away with that excuse, well, guess what? With respect to this discriminatory, anti-intellectual poison, there are going to be other people that come at you from the other direction and use the courts to do so.
Look, this. Thank God that she is finally suing. We needed a teacher to sue over this because she is standing up for hundreds, if not thousands, of other school teachers in Illinois, at least, and probably across the nation that are very concerned about what's happening in their school districts. And these school boards want to deny it. They want to call it everything but what it is, which is critical race theory. Instead, they want to just call it equity, or they want to call it social-emotional learning. It's not. It is the worst stuff that you could be propagating to young children. And I am so thankful that she is finally suing over this. Somebody is.
And to discuss this in additional detail, we're pleased to be joined by her counsel, Kimberly Herman, who's general counsel for the Southeastern Legal Foundation, that foundation representing Ms. DeMar in this suit. Kimberly, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me today and for bringing attention to the lawsuit that we filed this week.
And so give us sort of the four corners of the suit and your assessment of the prospects of the suit's success.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like you said, I mean, District 65 is really ground zero for the kind of race-based programming that you went through and that you listed and that we have in our complaint. And at the end of the day, it is illegal. It violates our civil rights laws, and it's unconstitutional. It violates the Equal Protection Clause. Because, you know, these schools seem to forget that they are arms of the government, right? Public schools are arms of the government. And we as parents know that they have the authority and the power. So in order to check that power, we have to go to the courtroom. And, you know, our client is very brave and she feels very strongly about this, as do many other people who have come forward in just the last 2 days since we filed this lawsuit. And, you know, the crux of our lawsuit is bringing forth the well-settled law that in America, you cannot treat people differently because of their skin color, right? It's what we call equality. I like to always kind of remind people of that, that equality is enshrined in the Constitution, and that is what this lawsuit is about. It is not, equality is not the same as equity, which is, as you mentioned, what the district has been pushing for many, many years now. The way that we see equity is that it's a license to punish Americans for their skin color.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why we had the civil rights movement in the first place. That's why the U.S. Supreme Court struck down school segregation in 1954. It is wrong. It is morally wrong. And it is legally wrong. And for the life of me, I cannot understand why District 65 wants to put us back 70 years when we had National Guardsmen coming in to enforce desegregation orders. Instead, they're actually segregating teachers and students. And so, you know, in a nutshell, that's really what the lawsuit is about. It is about equality. And it is about holding District 65 accountable to the Constitution.
You said other people have come forward since it was public that the suit had been filed. Other people, meaning like other teachers, are they supportive of Stacey DeMar, or they're wanting to file similar suits in other districts? What's the response? What do you mean by that response?
Yeah, well, we for months and really, I mean, before this became a massive national issue, which I'm so glad that it has. We have been talking to parents and teachers across the country, and this is the first in a series of lawsuits that Southeastern Legal Foundation is going to be filing in Illinois and in other states throughout the country. But, yeah, we have had, to be honest, overwhelming and support from the local community there, which to a degree was unexpected because, you know, our client has been fighting this battle for years. She filed a complaint with the Department of Education back in 2019. And in January of this year, the Department of Education actually formally found that District 65 violated federal civil rights laws. And 2 days, 3 days after Biden was inaugurated, the Department of Education withdrew that letter of finding with no explanation.
Right, of course.
Civil rights laws have been the same since 1964. They've only gotten stronger. And
well,
for some reason, yeah, apparently, they all changed the day that Biden became our president.
I wonder why that is. Golly gee. Yeah, administrations change and interpretations change along with them, don't they?
Well,
Has
there been an uproar in Evanston? There has been in other suburbs, parents going to the school boards talking about this issue, school boards and superintendents denying that they're doing this. But Evanston's pretty woke. I mean, they instituted reparations even prior to this. The school district was, charged that they were going to actually they were going to have a racist reopening policy, so to speak. So do you see any pushback from the local community there in Evanston?
I certainly expect there to be some. I believe that, you know, there have been maybe a statement made out there by the PTSA president to this point. But, you know, I think a lot of it, of the silence has come from fear to speak out, and also a lack of awareness as to what was actually going on. I mean, if you want to talk locally, we have parents that are interested in joining the suit. We have had other teachers come forward that are interested in joining the suit. Certainly did not expect that, because there have been parents who have spoken out about this at school board meetings in the past, but not to the level that we're seeing, you know, like in Loudoun County or some of the other places that have kind of gone viral around the country. You know, but when you look at this curriculum and you see that at the end of the day, what it's teaching is it's teaching and trying to get non-white kids to hate, and it's trying to get white kids to hate themselves. It is startling. It makes you stop in your tracks, in addition to the fact that it's unconstitutional. And I had a number of parents say to me, I had no idea. I know they talk about equity. I didn't understand what that meant. I didn't understand it was just a euphemism for critical race theory, for all of these other things. and really for conditioning individuals to see their skin, to see each other's skin color first. And that is not what we should be teaching. We should be teaching to look at the inside of a person.
Now,
look at who a person is.
For people listening to this who have kids in private school, because these elite private schools are, right, in many cases worse than the government school systems, because, of course, you have these, you know, the Chardonnay Antifa and the champagne socialists who send their kids to these $60,000 a year schools. Like Grace Church School in New York, and that math teacher, Paul Rossi, who made a splash by saying, I didn't come to the school. I'm not to teach, to treat my students differently based on the race. I'm not going to do it. And he was summarily dismissed. And he had tried to go through the proper channels and get some, redress to what was being promoted. And he was unable to do so. So he went public and he gets fired. Private school parents, like we have a very high-profile case going on at Loyola Academy, which is a Catholic school on the North Shore of Chicago, as you probably know. What's your advice and counsel for private school parents dealing with the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, there may be recourse for private school parents in the contract terms that they have. And I believe that there's going to be some groups out there that are going to try to kind of push the needle on that with private schools. But our focus here at Southeastern Legal Foundation really is public schools. We're a nonprofit, a 501c3, and our mission is to hold the government accountable when they violate the Constitution. So, my advice to those parents is speak up, get involved, be involved on the boards. My children are in private school personally, and I cannot subject them to this. Just stay as involved as you can and be an advocate for your children. And, if they're not going to listen, take your money somewhere else.
Well, I think other parents should also be aware that they're changing disciplinary policy based on some of the sort of racism. So they may see four or five incidences. They say, well, now we have to have a new disciplinary policy about how do we react if somebody has a racist incident. And literally, there's almost no racial incidents in many cases. And the other thing they should be aware of is that, they're all doing this because, we have to put in equity because we need to close the achievement gap without ever proving up that there is an achievement gap and that it's out of the norm and that doesn't comport with what their peer districts are doing. So there's this. I think people can also push back locally by just challenging the premises for why they're even instituting this instruction. In some cases, it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to put in the critical race theory. There's been no proof that it improves anything in terms of test scores or equity. It is racist at its face, but you have to read their documents. Even my own school district, which people think is conservative, it really isn't. I mean, they have an entire Vision 2022 thing, which is all about equity slides. You don't see equality at all. And so they have to learn the language of critical race theory, parents do, so they can properly identify it when they see it. And then they have to be very much aware of what they're doing in terms of disciplinary policy around this as well. And I think I parents need to sue. And I applaud you for what you do. And thank you so much for helping out in this area.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you guys for highlighting the case again. We really appreciate it.
Well, and just one follow-up, too, about the prospects for success and sort of the pitch battle that this is going to be, because it's great that Stacey DeMar has stepped up and you see this happening, the revolt going on in Loudoun County, Virginia, and South Lake, Texas, and elsewhere. But that doesn't mean that the other side is just, folding up their tents and going home, hardly. We just saw yesterday University of North Carolina caved and granted tenure to 1619 Project/critical race theorist Nicole Hannah-Jones. They still control these institutions. They're not going to lay down just because one teacher or some parents and one school district step up. So your sort of prognosis on this case and what this battle is going to look like, give people some perspective in terms of just how difficult this fight is going to be.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We don't expect them to roll over or anything like that. But the universe of these teacher trainings specifically out there is fairly small. There's a small number of companies who are paid a tremendous amount of money to come in and train these teachers on how to teach these students critical race theory, if we're going to use that term here. And so it's really making sure that we, you know, bring cases in the right places, and that when we get the court to declare that these trainings and that this curriculum is unconstitutional, we believe that's going to have a ripple effect throughout the country. Because if it's unconstitutional in one school district, it's surely unconstitutional in another school district. And they're using the exact same materials. I talked to teachers in states, Iowa, Missouri, North Carolina, New York, they have the exact same training that they're given. And so you get it ruled, you know, to be illegal and the court to halt it in one place, it's going to be halted in the other. So we have a really good, you know, a good prognosis here.
Can push the dominoes back in the other direction. I like it. Kimberly Herman, General Counsel for Southeastern Legal Foundation, representing Evanston Skokie District 65 drama teacher Stacey DeMar in her federal lawsuit. Kimberly, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And she joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.